Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And one of the reasons I emphasize conversations is that I think that the interview format or the conversational format, even better, is not just an interesting way to get information, to avoid reading a big long book when you can just listen to a podcast. I think that the form of the conversation, where there's an open back and forth between interlocutors, is a marvelous model for thinking and being in the world, a world where we're always involved with others, other perspectives, other objects, other points of view, other people, and that our views of reality, our interpretations of politics, of metaphysics, of God, of the problem of what to do, are always sort of in dialogue, and that the form of the conversation helps model a way of being and thinking about the world that is not often emphasized, because for a wide variety of reasons, it's often in the interests of people to put forward a very specific perspective and to argue for that perspective. It gives you a good, clear brand. It lets you, define a system that then can go on and influence other systems. And it's good that people do that, because it's important to wrestle with people who have very strong perspectives. But in my mind, and certainly in the spirit of this show, it's much more about creating an open field, even to cultivate what I could think of somewhat perversely as the excluded middle, which those of you who know your history of Western philosophy and logic will recognize that the idea of the excluded middle, the thing that can be both be X and not be X at the same time, is verboten. But I like the idea of the excluded middle as a model for a middle path, for a middle space where contrary possibilities can tentatively and perhaps even profoundly coexist. And I think this perspective is particularly important when we think about matters of consciousness, and particularly what's going on with consciousness. Is consciousness separate from the body? What's happening when we're dreaming? What happens in paranormal experiences, out-of-body experiences, lucid dreaming, and perhaps the greatest trip we'll all take, which is the process of dying. And I am enormously pleased to report that Evan Thompson's new book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, is just a phenomenal expression of this openness towards these questions, an openness that both looks at the phenomenological experience and claims of meditation, unusual states of consciousness, waking consciousness, and at the same time brings in very rigorous neuroscientific ways and philosophical ways of thinking about these problems in a profoundly open way. And I've read a lot of consciousness books out there. I think a lot of our listeners have read consciousness books out there. And this one is the most even-handed one that I've ever read. It's the one where you feel all points of view are respected, and when the author lands in certain kinds of conclusions, which are generally skeptical ones vis-a-vis kind of religious claims for parts of the mind that transcend the body and that can, live and move in other dimensions, there's still a great respect for this. And this is partly because Professor Thompson, who teaches philosophy, cognitive philosophy in British Columbia, grew up in a very interesting milieu, which we'll talk about, and is also one that's very close to my own heart. He's the son of William Irwin Thompson, which I'm sure some of listeners are aware of, a wonderful, path-breaking, brilliant writer. I wish there were more people writing like him today. On the one hand, a very intellectual fellow who writes very well and also is open to a lot of what we could call New Age experience. And so Evan grew up in a intelligent, New Age meditative yoga environment where there were also a lot of very high-powered, fascinating thinkers and scientists moving through who were part of the world that William Irwin Thompson created, great minds like Gregory Bateson, like Francisco Varela, who I had the great privilege of meeting and interviewing once many years ago in his wonderful office in Paris. And so I've been following this for a long time, and Evan Thompson co-wrote a book with Francisco Varela many years ago, which was one of the first books that really opened my mind to different ways of thinking about the problem of consciousness. This book, of course, is The Embodied Mind, Cognitive Science and Human Experience, in which Professor Thompson and Varela, and as is continued in the new book, Waking, Dreaming, Being, emphasize a wider view of what consciousness is, not just a little cognitive process, worry inside of the meat machine of the brain, but rather an embodied, emotional, affective, and relational kind of consciousness that's always in a world, that's always interacting with different experiences and different ways of being in a world. And that difference makes all the difference in my mind. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. But first, of course, we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja. You there?
Can you hear me?
Now I can't hear you.
Oh,
you
yay. Hi,
you were swallowed up. I, for a moment, I thought I was slipping out of this plane of reality.
It can happen at any time. You never know when it'll strike. Yeah, it's funny. You know, like you, I'm a big researcher of all things related to consciousness, and through all my studies, it never ceases to amaze the way that people approach studying consciousness. So we have like all these people thinking, trying to figure out what is this consciousness stuff, and some people like to approach looking at consciousness in a very sort of little tunnel or something very specific, and nothing else can go in there. And other people will look at it, well, let's look at everything. Let's see what everything is going on. So I think it's kind of a meta-level explanation when people can address even talking about consciousness in an open way. You know you're going to be in for some good stuff.
Absolutely, you know, especially given all the issues that come up, and particularly you know, dying and the nature of the afterlife and these heavy things. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Evan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. Do we got you there? Oh, it's a sketchy day.
Oh, you got swallowed too.
There we go. We got you.
Yeah, I'm on the landline at the moment. The sound that's coming through for me is not very good.
I would say that is also the case. We could switch over to Skype.
Hi.
I think. Because you're right, that is a little bit. So he's going to add you to this right now, so hopefully we can
be worth trying.
Okay. How are we doing?
All right.
There we go.
How is that?
That's much, much better. And thank you. And this, I actually like all this little futzing about right now, because it reminds me that after a year or so, the show is back streaming live, which I much prefer. Even though most people listen to it, you know, later on as an archive download, I enjoy the fact that it's going live. And so you get all these little fuzzy bits. So, Evan, thanks for joining us. And, you know, there's so much stuff to talk about. The time flies by. But I would like to ask you first, because you had such an interesting life growing up in this fascinating, really wonderful milieu that I think people don't pay enough attention to, I think was very, very important at the time. And I, as you, you know, grow up and became a, you know, official neuroscientist, cognitive science philosopher guy, and look back at these kinds of experiences. What are some of the things that you take away from growing up and all the people and sort of perspectives that were part of that world?
Well, it was that upbringing that really gave me the questions that are alive for me in the book, and also the perspectives from which I'm approaching them. So I was raised, as you mentioned, in an organization founded by my father, whose name is William Irwin Thompson, and he's a writer. And in the 1970s, when he was a professor, full professor with tenure, decided that the universities really weren't serving the needs of learning for what he felt the culture at the time needed. So he quit his position and he set up an alternative institution called the Lindisfarne Association. And it was also run as a residential community. And he tried to bring together scientists and scholars, philosophers, poets, artists, activists, ecologists. And so that was the milieu in which I was raised. So that's to say, I was really raised in a place where there was constant dialogue and debate about consciousness and politics and art and spirituality. And, you know, this shaped my sensibility when I was really young about the kinds of questions that were important and the kinds of questions that really grabbed me. I was always, I guess you could say, philosophically inclined. So questions about the mind and consciousness were the ones that kind of grabbed me even when I was a little kid. And I pretty much followed that impulse through my life. You know, I went away to college and studied Asian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, and Western philosophy. Then went on, got my PhD in Western philosophy, collaborated with people that I met at the Lindisfarne Association, like Francisco Varela, who was a very pioneering neuroscientist and also a serious Buddhist practitioner and student. So in the book, what I really try to do is to write about the question of consciousness, bringing those perspectives to bear, especially, you could say, the perspectives of science, Indian philosophy, and Western philosophy. And I try to do it in a way that has a personal narrative that, you know, connects to some of the things I experienced in my upbringing, and that you know, makes that come alive for the reader, hopefully, in a way that reflects, you know, where we are now, rather than, say, you know, where we were in the 1970s, or, you know, even, you know, at the beginning of this century, when people were just starting to, you know, do some of the work in the neuroscience of meditation that I talk about in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very clear that it's a sort of mature work of being in between these different philosophies and being able to move to translate between them, and that it overcomes this this tendency that human beings have in general, but certainly around these topics, which is to kind of fixate or fall into one side of the equation or the other. And so there are extraordinary meditation experiences or out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, that people have them personally, or they particularly read about them or write about them as a way of sort of driving a wedge into the neuromaterialistic view that we are just, you know, robotic DNA meat machines. And on the other side, you have the people who are, you know, pro-robotic DNA meat machines, who are interested in almost sardonically destroying and mocking people who hold out some possibility that there are things about consciousness that we don't understand that might be truly extraordinary vis-a-vis our current state of knowledge. And that this is often this polarity is really working, driving a lot of the discussion, and particularly in a lot of books written by people who are sympathetic to neuroscientists, to a more skeptical point of view, even if they're trying to be sort of friendly to, you know, these other possibilities, you really get a sense that they're basically waiting to kind of stick the knife in. And there's none of that in your book. And that alone, in addition to the wonderful stories and to the sense of your own journey and your own unique course through this sort of East-West discussion between Buddhism and science in particular, really opens it up, and to me seems like a represents not just your own work, but also a kind of maturing in this confrontation, where really as you know, we're all kind of philosophers on this ride, where, even if we have wonderful explanations about how an out-of-body experience could actually work from a skeptical point of view, which you do a wonderful job of explaining in your chapter on this fascinating topic, that we still have to remain open to the value and power of these experiences as experiences. And it's that phenomenological emphasis on our experience, regardless of what's quote unquote going on beneath the surface, that really makes a difference. So I'd love to hear, where did that kind of perspective come for you? That this idea that even if, whether we're looking at meditation or whether we're looking at, you know, fMRI studies of the brain, that the role of first person experience has to remain a central component of our understanding of these, you know, neuroscientific questions.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me it came from, you know, multiple sources. So you know, one source would be going back again to the kinds of people I met when I was growing up. You know, I was really fortunate to meet scientific thinkers like Gregory Bateson and Francisco Varela and, you know, Lynn Margulis, a biologist who did a lot of work on symbiosis and who was really instrumental, or one of the co-founders, you could say, of the Gaia theory, Gaia hypothesis. So I met just exceptional scientists who really in their scientific work never lost sight of the fact that the scientific quest or scientific investigation really has its source in lived experience and in a certain sense of awe and you know, mystery for the phenomena of nature and a curiosity about them and a way of trying to keep certain kinds of, you know, investigative questions open without you know, prejudicing what, you know, answers we might get as we go forward. So being exposed to thinkers like that and then seeing them in dialogue with artists and philosophers who also very much had that sensibility, I think, you know, for me that was an incredible learning experience, because it's not so much about the specific, you know, ideas in a content sense that you pick up from people. It's more what you pick up about a way of being, you know, open-minded and of realizing that, you know, experience is really the source. So that's one reason, or one source, I guess you could say. Then I also had the opportunity to work very closely with Francisco Varela for a number of years. We wrote our book, The Embodied Mind, together. We wrote a number of more technical papers together. And so I really had the opportunity, on the basis of my own training in philosophy, to work with someone to try to, you know, craft ideas in a written form that would reflect that or would embody that kind of, you know, open spirit. And then I suppose thirdly, I would say that just in terms of the kind of philosophies or philosophical traditions that I found myself most strongly drawn to. So in the case of Western philosophy, phenomenology is all about the importance of a very careful, open, analytical attention to the fabric of experience as the touchstone for philosophical thinking. And we see that kind of sensibility also reflected in certain strands of Indian philosophical thinking, Tibetan and Chinese thinking as well. So just in terms of the philosophical materials I was working with, there was that, you could say, kind of inbuilt idea of always keeping the relationship to experience open and alive.
Yeah, the one point in your book where it really, really came through for me where that difference really makes a difference, to, you know, echo Gregory Bateson, is when you were talking about accounts of near-death experiences. And so mm-hmm. we have these really robust experiential accounts. There's often a lot of commonality to them. They suggest these patterns of you know, going through tunnels, of encountering departed loved ones, senses of peace, sometimes hellish senses. And so there are a lot of people, including a number of scientists, who write books that sort of say, hey, this really shows that there's something that goes beyond consciousness and or as we understand it normally. And you kind of, you know, you express sympathy for that position, and then you go on to offer some solid neuroscientific explanations for how these things could happen that don't require changing our fundamental the kind of materialism that undergirds neuroscience. But then you just make this turn, which is that but now imagine that you're on your deathbed and you're going through this process. Do you care whether or not it's something that's just happening on the underlying neural level, or whether you're transitioning into another being? No, the whole point is to, can you remain calm? Can you remain awake in this process of extraordinary novelty and terror? And that really, really resonated with me, because I've often found the discussion around death and this question of the afterlife as being sort of beside the point, that my own experiences in meditation and frankly with psychedelics have given me a completely robust affirmation that it really doesn't matter, and that it is nonetheless extremely important to prepare oneself for the moment of death, because at that moment it's not going to make a difference whether it's the door is opening to another realm or whether you're just having an extraordinary ride as you snuff out, that the sublimity and bizarreness of that experience as a culminating moment calls forth a meditative mind. And so I really take a lot from the kinds of Tibetan practices and also dream yogas that you describe that sort of resonate with that experience. And it just also underscores that it really is about, in these regards, also fundamentally our own experience. And so you have that openness there. I mean, your chapter on death is probably one of my favorite ones in the book. And I'm curious, when you came to writing about that, what were the things you wanted to bring forward in terms of not just presenting ideas, but in encouraging or allowing readers like me to have their own experiences, to navigate their own way through these weighty matters?
Yeah, what I was trying to do in the writing of that chapter, which was in some ways maybe the most difficult chapter to write, and the one that, in a way, after having written, I felt really kind of achieved in some ways what I was trying to do in the writing overall in the book. I came into the writing of that chapter really from a couple different places. So one was just this sense that, as you were saying earlier, that there's this extremism in our culture right now around, you could say, a kind of, religious spiritual fervor about near-death experiences, showing, that there really is an afterlife, or there really is some kind of heavenly realm. So there's lots of popular books written in that vein. And then there's also now starting to be a kind of pushback against that, where people are arguing, no, these experiences are just, the last gasps of a dying brain, a very kind of materialistic perspective. And it seemed to me that both of these were really missing this fundamental point, that the experience of dying is something that, we all eventually are going to have to face in one way or another. And that what contemplative traditions are really about, both Asian traditions but also Western traditions, is really preparing one for the inevitability of that. So I wanted to try to work with that as a guiding idea, but bring it to life in a way that would speak to where we are now in our culture, which is, a culture that's on the one hand very scientifically informed, but in a way that, tends to lead towards a kind of excessive materialism, or this kind of popular naivete that because you have a certain, kind of experience, it shows the reality of, heaven or the soul after the death of the body or something like that. So I wanted to try to find a way through those extremes and bring it back to this touchstone of the importance of what your mind and what your experience are going to be like when that eventually happens to you. And that's where the contemplative traditions really speak strongly. And also, I would say, literary tradition. So I use Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Illich a fair amount in that chapter to also try to make that point. And part of the chapter also came out of a kind of mini journey of discovery for me, which was at one point I received a letter from a very prominent near-death experience researcher saying that that he very much liked my idea, which was really Francisco Varela's idea of neurophenomenology, of putting together a neuroscience view of the brain with a phenomenological view about experience. And then he said, but, you know, near-death experiences show the limits of the neuroscientific perspective. And I thought that was really intriguing. I knew about near-death experiences, but I didn't really know, you know, the literature around them. And he was someone, Pim van Lommel, who's, you know, had published in medical journals like The Lancet. So these are very prestigious medical journals. So I thought, well, that's really interesting. You know, maybe that's actually a phenomenon that scientists haven't looked that closely at and that philosophers have said nothing about, and that maybe there's an anomaly there that would challenge, you know, the neuroscience paradigm. So I started really closely reading this literature. And as I went further and further into it, I saw that a lot of claims were being made that went way beyond what the evidence actually would support. And that was, you know, that was quite revealing for me. And so I try to convey that as well in the chapter, that there is, you know, important evidence that's starting to come out from neuroscience and clinical medicine that shows that these experiences, you know, they really are robust in certain circumstances. People really do have them. But we shouldn't interpret them in the ways that they're standardly interpreted, either, you know, in a spiritualist way, a kind of naive spiritualist way, or on the other hand, in a reductionist way, that we need a different way to understand the significance and meaning of these experiences. And that for me is kind of, you could say, in microcosm, that tells us in microcosm something about the way that our culture constantly, you know, runs away from death. You know, we have an incredible biomedical apparatus that's been fantastic at, you know, being able to save people in traumatic circumstances, being able to cure certain kinds of illness and prolong lifespan. But it's come at the expense of really hiding ourselves from the phenomenon of death in the way that we wouldn't be able to at earlier times in history. And that we've lost the spiritual contemplative resources for dealing with this phenomenon. And we need somehow to recover those, but in a way that, you know, keeps us working with the best of our science. And so that's...
Well, and let me ask you this, just out of curiosity, if in the process of your research, did you find, like, is there, like Eric said, does it matter? Did you find any correlation to that, those more intense experiences? I mean, did people who did contemplative meditation or were religious, did they have those more intense experiences, or was it more like average Joes who were just dum-dums and not anything kind of special? Or was there, like, in other words, is this just something that's going to happen to us no matter what we do, that's kind of there in extant on a neurological, very real, very scientific level? Or is there some kind of consciousness that it takes in order to kind of have it go on? Or is that just kind of not able to say based on the information?
I don't think we really know the answer to that question. There are a lot of different factors that come into play in the having and in the reporting of these experiences and the way that they're narrated. And I would say that, you know, what we can say is that we know that there are certain sort of brain phenomena that are probably basic to the human organism that we would expect to find, you know, across different individuals and cultures. And then in terms of the way the experiences are narrated, often they're interpreted in a cultural frame. So if you are a religious person, you are very much more prone to interpret these experiences according to the religious framework that you have. We don't know, as a matter of fact, whether if you're, for example, if you're someone who practices meditation, whether that's, you know, going to affect the frequency, the likelihood of an experience like this, or how the experience would unfold in terms of its some of its finer qualities. I don't think we know the answers to those questions. I mean, those point towards things that would be, you know, interesting and important to research.
Yeah, this reminds me of another person I'd love to get on the show sometime. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work. She's a scholar of religion named Anne Taves. She wrote a wonderful book called Religious Experience Reconsidered. And what she's trying to do there is, like you, from an essentially, you know, more standing on the neuroscientific side, but to go into the nitty-gritty detail of how people reconstruct and narrate their extraordinary experiences, and trying to kind of finesse at what point are there sort of experiences of intensity, of light, of unusual sort of phenomenological experiences, and then at what point do they get coded or mapped or narrated according to these sort of narrative or language-based ways of organizing the world. And that's when you start to see differences between people who have certain kinds of religious understandings and other kinds. And it's a wonderful study because it shows how we can go, and you talk about this in your book too, one of the things you call for is much better ways of encouraging people to report their experiences. One of the things that happens is that I think a lot of scientists are pretty naive, actually, about the complexities of narration and reporting. And so they either like just go, oh, it's proof of something marvelous, or it's proof that people are stupid and don't understand what's actually happening, when the action is in the nitty-gritty detail of bouncing back and forth between stories and, you know, flushes of experience or intensities or affects that are bubbling around in these extraordinary experiences. And I think that there's a lot more to do there.
Yeah, I agree. And another case of that same idea, you know, without even going as far as the near-death experience case, is just the phenomenon of dreaming. We know that there are, you know, certain kinds of cultural practices that go into how you recount a dream, how you make a dream into a story, that how people sleep across cultures in terms of the amount of time they sleep, when they sleep, whether they sleep alone or in groups, that all these things are really profoundly shaped by social context and culture. And yet a lot of the dream research has been, you know, limited to the particular context of the sleep lab, where people are, you know, wired up in certain ways, woken up in certain ways, asked certain kinds of questions. And that research is great. That, you know, I rely on that research a lot. But there's a much richer, culturally situated phenomenon of how people will shape a dream in the telling of the dream as a story. So that's, you know, that's another example of something that's, you know, much more immediate in a way and widespread than the particular phenomenon of near-death experiences as, you know, as we know it now in our culture.
Great. Well, I want to talk more about dreams, but first we got to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Evan Thompson, and we'll be right back.
This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. And we are speaking with Evan Thompson. We're talking about waking, dreaming, and being today. And before the break, it had been brought up a little bit about your father and your upbringing and, stressing experience and drawing from personal experience. And I was just wondering, you know, obviously it's loaded when you're involved with family business. I'm always fascinated by ancestor work and seeing, like, you know, if you kind of are set into a family where your parents do something, a lot of people have this choice of like, well, am I going to do what my parents did, or am I going to rebel and find my individuality? So I always like when those two things can kind of, you know, find that middle space where you can do both, which it seems like you totally have accomplished. So I was wondering if you remember like a specific time where some of the philosophies or ideas you had been learning about through your father and through your environment, if you remember having a personal experience that kind of helped you to form your own kind of feeling of it, as opposed to just the, you know, taking it in from your environment or family. Did you have any, like, of those standout sort of personal experiences that really set you on in your direction?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I think that so I went away to college when I was quite young. I was 16 years old when I went to Amherst College to study. And I think that the experience of, you know, leaving the world of Lindisfarne and, you know, and going away to college was an experience that actually, you know, challenged a lot of the ideas that I had been raised with. And so there were points along, you know, along that stretch that were, that were kind of disorienting for me, and I had to struggle to really kind of find my way in figuring out things that didn't sort of just rely on, you know, ideas that I had been raised with. So I actually talk about that, you know, just a little bit in the book. For example, you know, I had when I was very young, I had some out of body experiences, and you know, I was given, you know, by my dad and, you know, by the people I lived with, a kind of cosmology that told me what, you know, what those experiences were about and what they meant. And you know, it was a cosmology of, you know, the body isn't just physical; there are non-physical, you know, astral body, etheric body, a kind of, you know, theosophical yoga cosmology of the body. And that's kind of, you know, that was my worldview. And then I, you know, started studying philosophy and science and realized, oh, you know, there are other perspectives. And so that was initially kind of disorienting. But then I kind of thrived on it. I found it actually exhilarating that there were other perspectives and that, you know, that there was critical investigation that could go on of these things that sort of had seemed so real and sure to me. And that's kind of what, I guess, kind of drove me more and more into philosophy and science, which, you know, I'd certainly been exposed to when I was younger, but it wasn't necessarily the you know, the dominant approach that, say, my dad would take. I mean, my dad is an artist and a poet and a writer, so I, you
it's
know, I've inherited
like you went
some
into
of
the opposite of what you write.
Yeah,
you looked at the exact
yeah,
opposite.
Exactly. I sort of inherited some of the, you know, the approach through writing and thinking, but, you know, I went really strongly into philosophy, whereas his inclination is sort of more the, you know, the wild Irish, you know, kind of bardic approach.
Well, and so did you, like, in your research in dreams, as you were mentioning shortly before the break, did you personally kind of start to open up those practices? Do you have a personal dream practice that you do, or do you more like do research in that department?
Yeah, I do. I don't know if I would say now I have a personal dream practice, but I would say that when I was writing the book, I've always been a pretty vivid dreamer, and ever since I was a kid, I've always just been fascinated by dreams, and would talk to people about them, talk to my parents about them. So that's always kind of been very present in my mental life. But when I was writing the book, especially, I would do a lot of things like keep a dream notebook. I would wake myself up at certain times in the night. I would, you know, sleep in the afternoon because that period is more conducive to certain kinds of sort of lucid dreaming, sleep paralysis experiences. So while I was writing the dream chapters, especially, I was really focused on my dream life. And, you know, that's maybe a little, it's not the case that I'm quite so focused on it now because, you know, that was a particular period of, you know, intense working.
Right.
But I would say that just in general, I'm someone who's very kind of interested and fascinated by that.
Yeah. I think you're writing on the dream stuff is really, really compelling. And there's one point that you make that it's sort of subtle in some ways, but I think significant, very significant in others, where you're talking about, of course, one of the, if you mention dream work and dreaming, almost inevitably people start talking about lucid dreaming, like lucid mm-hmm. dreaming, sort of the great, the goal, you know, that's where you want to drive towards. And there's some support to that in Tibetan dream work. There's a lot of emphasis on becoming aware of the dream, but you make this subtle distinction that I think really, says a lot about a lot of things, which is you talk about how in the West, particularly in the sort of more secular discussion of dreaming as a practice, and certainly in terms of the dream labs, that the lucid dream is described or thought of as a dream in which you can control the dream. And to some degree, this is true. I am aware that I'm in a dream. Wait, if it's a dream, I can do whatever I want. I could fly. I can, you know, whatever. I can shape it. And you make a distinction between the control of the dream associated with lucidity and simply the awareness that one is dreaming, an almost more open, less manipulative mind frame that can kind of, in my experience anyway, go back and forth with the control. Sometimes there's a moment of control. Oh, I'm dreaming. Oh, I can fly. And then as soon as I embark on flying, a bunch of other stuff happens that I'm no longer in control of. But I am aware of it in a different way. And there's something that awareness provides, whether you're thinking about it in terms of Tibetan dream work or in a more secular frame, there's something about the awareness that is provided or that is opened up in that mind frame that's very different than the kind of, hey, it's a video game, you can do whatever you want, emphasis that you often find in discussions around dreaming. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that contemplative potential within dream work.
Yeah, so I think that you could say from a phenomenological or experiential perspective that there's really an important distinction to be made between what happens when you become aware of the dream as a dream, simply that form of awareness, and then any subsequent decision that you might make to try to affect the dream or control the dream. Those are really very different. Very different things. And in a contemplative approach to lucid dreaming, you can work with both, but in a way it's the awareness of the dream as a dream, the recognition of the dream state, as it would be called in, say, the Tibetan yoga, dream yoga practices. That's really the crucial fundamental basis for the phenomenon of lucidity. And then I would say that it's also important to be aware that there's different forms that lucidity can take. So you might, in the course of having a dream, all of a sudden, or maybe not even suddenly, it might take some time to progress, have a kind of implicit, you might even say nonverbal awareness that the state is a dream state. But you're not necessarily thinking explicitly to yourself, oh, this is a dream. So you can have, you might say, a more kind of implicit, nonverbal form of awareness, lucid awareness, or you might have a much more explicit, this is a dream, and if it's a dream, then I'm going to try to meditate in the dream, or I'm going to try to change something in the dream. That's a more explicit kind of awareness that's present. So these kinds of distinctions are, I think, really experientially quite profound, and they're ones that, from the lucid dream science perspective, haven't really been investigated too much because, lucid dreaming has actually not been studied that much. It's only really beginning to be studied from a more scientific perspective.
One of the other dimensions that you talk about that I also think does not get nearly enough attention in the discussions of dreaming is the hypnagogic state as we descend into sleep. And you have a similar practice as me, and I'm sure many people that you do talk about that began very young, where as you go to sleep, you see how long you can stay awake and be aware of the moment when you fall asleep. And doing that occasionally, in my experience, one stays awake as the dreaming begins. And there's a particular stage that has its own characteristics that's different than deeper dreams of hypnagogia, and you describe an account that Nabokov gives of his own experiences in this state, which I find are really remarkable. Just to make it very brief, one of the things that happens to me on occasion once or twice a year is that I'm going to sleep, I realize I'm still awake and I'm in a hypnagogic dream. I'm quite aware of that part of it. And then there's some, usually an audio source, I start hearing, like I'm hearing a voice, or it's almost like turning into a radio. And sometimes it's remarkable music. I enjoy the music. People come on, they tell stories, and it's not me. And I'm sitting there going, look, if this is me making this up, then I am much more creative than I feel. And I'm right now, I'm just sort of watching this happen. But I'm very much aware that it's a phenomenon in my mind, that it's not like I'm in some magical other world, even though it could be that. But it's like I can just sort of witness the process. And in your book, you say this tells us something very interesting about what dreams are and how they relate to imagining, and how imagination is not simply something that we direct as conscious egos. Well, I'm going to imagine now what tomorrow is going to be like when I, you know, don't bring in my term paper to the professor. Well, okay, that's a certain kind of imagining. But there's clearly something going on in imagining and imagination that's much larger than my ego and my daily memories and projections and fears. And so I'd love to hear that. Like, what does that tell you, that sense of the incredible fecundity of the imagination that one can actually literally witness in these states of hypnagogy, visually and orally?
Yeah, so that's one of the central ideas I try to play with in the book, is that dreaming and hypnagogia are really phenomena of the imagination, and that the imagination has a kind of creative spontaneity, you might even say a kind of self-generative power that is very much not a function of the waking controlling ego. And of course, artists and great scientists have known this. I mean, this isn't really news in a way, from a broader perspective. But it is, I think, important to recover, because it's not the way dreams are usually talked about in the neuroscience of dreaming. Usually they're talked about as hallucinations, as delusions. They're often modeled, and this in a way comes from Freud, they're often modeled on mental illness. And I think that there are some similarities there that are, worth exploring, but that's a pretty limited and impoverished way of thinking about dreaming. So dreaming for me needs to be, along with, mind wandering, daydreaming, hypnagogia, all of this needs to be seen in the context of the imagination. And what the imagination, I think, really points us to is, you could say, the self-organizing nature of consciousness, that consciousness or the mind has its own kind of inner rhythms, its own autonomous self-organizing dynamics that's constantly on the move. And in dreaming, of course, you really see it on the move. That's one of the interesting things about dreaming, or in lucid dreaming, you get to see it on the move in a different way. But it's always there. It's always going on. I mean, think of how much when you're walking down the street, you're just in a spontaneous kind of, mind-wandering, daydreaming, reverie. Maybe it's, more mundane. Maybe it's going to lead you to some great insight. But this is always going on. Our minds are constantly working in this way. And I think, dreaming is really valuable for showing that to us in a very vivid way.
Yeah, my view in this stuff was really opened up by the thought that one of the ways of characterizing the difference between dreaming and waking is that in waking we are just continuing that process of modeling the world with the imagination. It's just that we're getting tons of sensory feedback that's constraining the degree to which we elaborate and fill in the world that we're experiencing. However scientific this perspective is, the one thing that it does that I really like thinking this way is that it emphasizes the continuity between dreaming and waking, as opposed to the way we normally experience, which is that in waking we're in reality. That's we're thinking because we're relating to reality, and then in dreaming we get to go crazy for a little while, and it doesn't really mean very much. Whereas if you look on the dreaming side, they're actually dreaming all the time. It's just that meaning dreaming in the sense of constructing our world in the real time by projection and filling in that. That then there's this kind of marvelous like underground river between the two worlds, and it's interesting because it creates a different way of being in the world, and that makes me think of whether you're thinking about dreaming or death or out of body experiences or just normal waking, how the kinds of ideas, the kinds of ways of thinking about these states of consciousness that you talk about in the book, how they actually have changed the way you feel, you experience your own kind of day to day, how there's a whatever, a suppleness, an openness, mundane things are no longer quite as mundane because they're involving these processes. How has it really sort of impacted your experience as an experiencing being?
Well, I think, you know, it sensitizes one to a lot of things that, you know, one might otherwise just dismiss or treat as somehow, you know, marginal. You know, we're a culture that's very, you know, task driven and work focused. And so oftentimes we either dismiss these, you know, these kinds of ongoing imaginative forms of thought, or we turn around and we, you know, we just kind of valorize them to an extreme in, you know, particular contexts where, you know, raves or, you know, Burning Man or whatever it might be, where, you know, like we set aside, you know, just times for nothing but that. And that's not really very integrated from a larger perspective. So, I mean, in terms of my own experience, I would say that, you know, what's important for me, and this is something I've really learned through, I guess you could say, through meditation practice, is to try to develop, for lack of a better word, a kind of mindfulness of this imaginative life of the mind. And that, you know, can take different forms. It can take a form of, you know, sitting meditation where you're really sort of in a way watching whatever comes up from moment to moment. But it can take other forms. I practiced Tai Chi for many years, and, you know, there in the context of movement or standing meditation, you know, thoughts and associations arise, but, you know, your relation to them is different if you're moving or if you're trying to maintain a certain posture. So all of these practices in these different ways, I think, you know, sensitize you to your own mind in a way that, you know, can be a real, at least, you know, for some people can be a real source of creativity, of thoughts if they're doing philosophy or, you know, if they're writing poetry or whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the elements there, we just have a few more minutes here, is the relationship to the body, because I think people can still be pursuing these, let's call them spiritual practices like yoga or meditation, but still be doing it in a rather kind of disembodied way, where this mm-hmm. is sort of my mind, and now I'm going into my mind, and I'm you know, communing with these sort of more subtle parts of the self, and while that's partly what's going on, my experience doing these things over years off and on is that in some ways it just brings you even closer to what your body's doing. That, you know, when in sitting meditation, there are certain things that happen in certain positions that don't happen in other positions. And I personally just realized this because for years I would sit in lotus position, full lotus position, and I love it. And then I had a problem with my knee and I had to switch my meditation. I had to sit on a bench. And it's a very subtle shift. It's like, but I can tell the difference. I can feel the way that it works different on my spine and that this opens up different possibilities. And there's a subtle shift, even in that shift of physical motion. And you talk in the book about, or at least in an interview, about a standing meditation in Tai Chi where you're still, but you're standing, and that this actually opens up a different kind of modality. And in those experiences, we really sense that there isn't a distinction between mind and body ultimately, and that there are different capacities that sort of fold into one another. I mean, it's hard to language, but it does seem that there's an embodied way of practicing these spiritual disciplines that can be further brought out, further kind of opened up in the way we think about them than people necessarily do.
Definitely. I mean, that's a theme also of the book, is you could call it a kind of non-dualism of the mind and body.
Well, we just got a couple of minutes here, and I'd like to hear, I don't know, I mean, how you reflect on what this book is and how you hope it goes out there. I mean, as I said at the beginning, there's a lot of There's tons of books on consciousness, too many.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of and people are very fascinated with it, but it's hard to approach, especially as a non-scientist. What do you hope happens here? What are you proud of with this work?
Well, I suppose really what I hope for most is that, you know, people read the book and it gives them new materials for really thinking about their own experience of things like waking and sleeping and dreaming and out of body experiences, that it, you know, gives them some ideas from Western science, from philosophy and phenomenology, from Indian philosophy, and that, you know, they'll take from this something that enriches their lives. I do argue for certain, you know, scientific philosophical positions in the book. I try to do so in the best way that I can, but I'm not really the value for the book for me is not so much trying to convince people of those things, but trying to show them a certain way of thinking and hope that, you know, they can take something from it that's going to enrich their lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think that last point is really important to emphasize, because there is such a difference between the desire to tear down the worldviews that people construct as if it's some kind of zero-sum game, and the scientist gets the last word and gets to kind of declaim against other ways of constructing reality, versus saying that there is a way of that there are explanations that are robust that make it more complicated, that you have to be more aware of how you're constructing your views based on the evidence of out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences, for example. But those are really different ways of approaching it, and I think that that difference is an important one to emphasize. I also wanted to let people know that if you just want a taste of waking, dreaming, being, there's a nice $2 Kindle essay that's based on the dying chapter, Dying, What Happens When We Die, and that's a nice way of getting a little chunk of the book and one of the most, to my mind, important parts of it, or at least fascinating parts of it. That's another thing to check out there. And anything else coming up, Evan?
Well, I would say right now I'm kind of in a phase where I'm doing lots of reading for new ideas, and happy to have finished this book and trying to, you know, keep myself open for whatever comes up next.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Great. Well, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.